Good afternoon. What an obedient crowd. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I am still Dean Reuter, and it's my honor to introduce our next speaker. Carly Fiorina possesses every characteristic one could hope to find in a leader. She's a strong advocate for conservative policies, free markets, and entrepreneurship. In her many and varied experiences, she stands as a testament to the proposition that a combination of hard work, determination, and faith can overcome all obstacles. She began her career as a secretary for a real estate business in 1977. She became an AT&T sales representative in 1980, and she steadily but fairly quickly worked her way up to manage AT&T's spinoff of Lucent Technologies and then Lucent's North America operations. By 1999, she began at Hewlett-Packard, where she became the first woman to lead a Fortune 50 business as chairman and CEO. Marshaling resources that included over 170,000 employees worldwide, in very short order, she doubled HP's revenue to $90 billion and quadrupled its rate of growth. And under her leadership, HP amassed an astounding rate of 11 patents a day. By 2010, Mrs. Fiorina decided to take her experience to the public sector, seeking election as a U.S. Senator from California. Although that bid was ultimately not successful, she garnered more votes than any other Republican candidate that election cycle. Today, among other things, Mrs. Fiorina serves as chairman of the board of directors of the American Conservative Union Foundation. I frankly hope her electoral career is not over, but that remains to be seen. But for now, please join me in welcoming Carly Fiorina.
Thank you so much, Dean, for that gracious introduction. Thank you for having me, and good afternoon, everyone. I want to start by thanking all of you for the work you've done over the last 30-plus years in fostering the growth of the legal conservative movement and the appointment of judges who say what the law is rather than what they think it should be. My father was one of those judges, Judge Joseph Sneed. He was a proud conservative. Thank you so much. He was a proud conservative on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, a rather lonely voice until Judges Kaczynski and O'Scanlan were appointed by Reagan. And standing before you this afternoon is a law school dropout. Yep, I only made it through a single semester. And my dad, I think, would be very proud that I am standing before so many distinguished legal minds. I think he would consider it a redemption of sort. So although I chose a different path than all of you, I have developed a profound appreciation for the practice of judicial restraint through the work that I have done. And so permit me to tell you a little bit of my own story. From my mother, I learned this. She told me when I was a little girl of 8 years old, she said, "What you are is God's gift to you. What you make of yourself is your gift to God." From my father, I learned that character is the core of who we are and the foundation of what we can become. Integrity, he taught me, is defined by what we do, how we act, what we choose, how we decide, especially when no one is looking, or when we have the power to do whatever we like. And both my parents believed that no one of us is better than any other one of us. And so they taught, while self-respect and self-confidence are important, humility and respect for others are required in equal measure. I graduated from Stanford University with a degree in medieval history and philosophy. So what else could I do? I had to go to law school. And it was during a discussion of one of the cases of Judge Learned Hand that I decided the law was not for me. All of this emphasis, I told my dad, on precedent and the past, I wanted to focus on the new and the future. You might say that I had a typical young person's desire to make things better. And of course, that is the powerful appeal of judicial activism, a subject to which I will return. And so I quit law school. And to earn a living, I went back doing full-time what I had done part-time to help put myself through college. I typed, and I filed, and I answered the phones. Eventually, I would enter the world of business and the world of technology, and then later, the world of philanthropy. And I must say, as I have traveled and lived and done business all around the world, I reflect so often that my story is only possible in the United States of America. Our founders, you see, knew what my mother taught me, that everyone has God-given gifts, and that everyone should have the opportunity to find them and to use them. Our founders knew that every life has potential, the potential to invent, to create, to make the world better, to live a life of dignity and purpose and meaning. This is indeed what they meant when they said life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But our founders also knew that for human potential to be fulfilled, the use of power must be restrained, lest it be abused. As I have lived and worked, I have seen over and over that human potential is indeed the only limitless resource we have in this world. When it is unlocked, when it is focused on worthy goals and common purpose, then truly everything is possible. I have seen this in my work as the chairman of Opportunity International, one of the largest microfinance organizations in the world. We serve destitute and desperate people all over the world. 91% of our clients are women. We've lent almost $6 billion around the world, starting at $150 at a time. And I have seen women and men with nothing but potential. And yet I have seen them lift themselves and their families up and build a life of dignity and purpose and meaning. And I've seen it as well. When I came to Hewlett-Packard and saw a company that had lost its way, a company with a vaunted central research laboratory, and yet a company that no longer even showed up in the list of the top 25 innovators in the world, and I saw how people focused and began over the course of 6 years to generate 11 patents every single day. But human potential cannot be unlocked unless the rule of law prevails, because the rule of law holds accountable those most powerful among us, and it protects those who are powerless. And of course, our founders intended that laws should be relatively difficult to enact, requiring careful deliberation and some degree of consensus achieved among representatives of the people. They knew, as I have come to know over a lifetime of experience, that it is a very fine line between the rule of law that enables and empowers and unleashes human potential and the heavy-handed crushing of the entrepreneurial and innovative spirit when some, who think they know better than others, decide that their job is to direct the activities of others, or redirect the decisions of others. To choose to strictly follow the law in the hard cases takes a very special kind of person, someone of profound integrity, with the courage and the intellect to do their duty, but equipped also with wisdom and willpower to refuse to go beyond their role, to refrain from attempting a job that our system assigns to legislators or to advocates or to commentators or to citizens. That kind of understanding comes from humility, a trait in leaders that we probably undervalue at our peril. Here is the way my father put it in one of his dissents on the Ninth Circuit. He said, and I quote, "Judicial review should reflect both deference to the elected branches of government and deference to the varied but rational determinations of the 50 states." The Supreme Court supported his decision. In that case, ultimately, my father was very proud of the fact that he was never reversed by the Supreme Court. But it was, nevertheless, at the Supreme Court, a 5-4 decision showing how precariously close we have been and remain to the dominance of the philosophy of judicial activism and indeed at the limit of this view, a form of federal judicial supremacy. I remember that case. I remember my father agonizing over that case. It had to do from the had to do with California's three strikes and you're out case. Law, and he agonized over his ruling because the facts of that case were heartbreaking, but the rule of law was clear. And I remember as well the criticism he took for his decision and the difficulty that that caused him. Judicial restraint is the consequence of character, because judicial restraint is a consequence of self-restraint. Consider for a moment the statue that overlooks our courthouses, the image of Lady Justice with her blindfold and her sword. Do you imagine that someone else put the blindfold on her? Unlikely. She, after all, is the one holding the sword. If she wears a blindfold, it is because she put it on herself. She was not born blind, any more than she was born armed. But in order to ignore what cannot matter to the law, she takes up that limitation when she takes up that sword so as to restrict the power of the state within clear bounds. We take Lady Justice now as a symbol of impartiality, but properly understood, I believe she is much more. She is the representation of limited government, limited by her own restraint. Although this path is of our judges, it is not theirs alone. Madison, whose silhouette we meet under, wrote in Federalist 55 that whatever prudent safeguards we might devise, government in our republic would still make great demands on the integrity and the devotion to duty of office holders, the personal virtues and character appropriate to self-government that require, first of all, the capacity to govern oneself. This sort of restraint does not come, at least reliably, it does not come from a grudging sacrifice or a kind of asceticism, although tough choices are, of course, inevitable. Constitutional fidelity is a positive virtue, not a negative one, and it is rooted in love for the law and for this country that overcomes any temptations to depart from it. Constitutional fidelity comes from humility. And it comes as well, I think, from a profound appreciation that human potential is a powerful force for progress if it is guided by the wisdom and the experience of the many, not directed by the decisions of the few. The important task of society then, and the important task for us all, is to maintain a role for law in our national life that is faithful to the vision of the Constitution as enacted, and especially to assure that our judicial system keeps that faith. I know that the Federalist Society prides itself on nonpartisanship, and indeed the constitutional philosophy of judicial restraint and judicial modesty should be nonpartisan. But unfortunately, it is not always so. And so I hope you will forgive me if I point out a few facts. Some elites within one of our great parties have for some time favored the judicial activist view and have appointed judges accordingly. And so long as this is true, elections will matter. And already, there is a substantial majority of Democratic appointees on the federal courts, many of them selected by a president and staff who were part of the same law school environment where activist jurisprudence has been endorsed for decades. I believe it is true that real freedom, the kind of freedom that unlocks potential for progress, the potential for daring, for doing, for dreaming, that kind of real freedom requires as well real restraint and real humility. I got involved in politics when I realized that the policies and the personnel that politicians choose impact our lives in profound ways. And I have seen too many lives and too many livelihoods sacrificed at the altar of liberal ideology. And yet politics, of course, is also a thing that is within our power to change. And so to do that, we must make the case for judicial restraint in a way that transcends our national division between right and left. And it is for this purpose that what we are doing today and what the Federalist Society does every day becomes so important. We have to, I think, break free of the persistent narrative that reduces constitutional principle to just the usual battles between the Republicans and the Democrats. What we know, and the proponents of judicial activism do not, or worse, perhaps they know, but refuse to acknowledge, is that the fundamental contest of ideas in which we are engaged is far more profound and fundamental than partisan politics. Our nation was founded on a visionary idea that everyone has potential and that everyone has the right to fulfill their potential. And to preserve these possibilities for future generations, to unleash the potential of every American and of our great nation in this, the 21st century, a love for the Constitution and the free society that it envisions must become the bedrock commitment for more of our legal community, for our legislators, and indeed for our presidents. And it must be spread widely among all of our citizens as part of the ideal of citizenship itself. So I will close by saying thank you for the work of the Federalist Society in this great mission. Let us continue to reach out to all Americans with the daring and inspirational message of the founding generation. Let us together pledge ourselves to the renewal of our nation and to the preservation for our children of the greatest privilege a people has ever been granted, the ability to govern ourselves. Thank you so very much.
We've got about 10 minutes left for questions, if people want to line up for questions. Carly Fiorina has agreed to take your questions. Let me begin by asking a question. You mentioned the right to invent. You mentioned inventions, innovation, patents. Maybe you could hold forth, if you would, on the Innovation Act and give us some of your thoughts on that, if you could.
Well, thank you. I'd be delighted. Would you like me to? Okay. I'd be delighted. You know, I talked a lot about restraint. And one of the things that we have seen lately is sort of vast, sweeping pieces of legislation accompanied by even more vast and sweeping regulation. We've seen it in Dodd-Frank, and we've seen it in the Affordable Care Act. Why do I start with those things? Because I think it's important to understand
the Innovation Act in the context of those two pieces of legislation. Here's what I know as someone who led a $90 billion business for 6 years. Only big companies can deal with vast, sweeping legislation and regulation. And there has been a habit of late to identify a particular problem and then to put a vast, sweeping piece of legislation around it. So Dodd-Frank started out as, we have a problem, we have to protect consumers. But the consequence of Dodd-Frank has been that 10 banks too big to fail became 5 banks too big to fail, with record bonuses all around. And meanwhile, the community banking system is on its back. And that's bad because the community banking system is what gives Main Street and Main Street entrepreneurs its credit. In other words, the big got bigger and the smaller got weaker. The Affordable Care Act began because we had a problem. People with pre-existing conditions couldn't get health insurance. That is a real problem. And healthcare was too expensive. That's a real problem too. But after we passed a piece of legislation that is literally longer than a Harry Potter novel, and accompanied it with tens of thousands of pages of additional regulation, what do we have now? Everybody has a problem. And this is exactly, I believe, what is going on with the Innovation Act. There is a problem in some of our patent system. There are people who use the threat of patents inappropriately. But here we have, supported by big technology companies, here we have a vast, sweeping piece of legislation called the Innovation Act. By the way, who could possibly be against the Innovation Act? It's important to read the fine print. It's a vast, sweeping piece of legislation that creates so many problems, but the most severe problem created by that kind of sweeping legislation, the most severe problem of all, is that the big will get bigger and the individual inventor will get weaker. And if you doubt that, I will say that Thomas Edison would be considered a patent troll in this piece of legislation. And the man who invented the lonely single inventor who invented the cancer medicine that saved my life might well be considered a patent troll as well. So I would say restraint matters, not just with judges, but with legislators as well.
That might mark the first mention of a Harry Potter novel in our in our convention history. Why don't we have microphones in the front and the back. Why don't we start with a question here in the front? We don't have much time, so I'm going to ask folks to be as concise as possible with their questions, please.
Almost as a follow-on to what you just said, because of your distinguished accomplishments, a lot of leaders do come to you for their advice. If someone was asking you for what they should do in, say, a next administration to help our economy escape the slow growth pattern we're currently trapped in, what would be your platform?
We absolutely must revitalize Main Street and the middle class. And to do that, we have to lift the weight that is crushing the entrepreneurial spirit of this nation. Those are big words, crushing. But here's the data. We are now, for the first time in U.S. history, destroying more businesses than we are creating. Fewer small businesses are starting and more are failing than at any time in the last 40 plus years. Big are getting bigger. Crony capitalism is alive and well. But the individual small business owner and inventor is struggling. That matters to creating jobs because two-thirds of the new jobs in this country are created by new and small businesses, and half the people in the nation are employed by small businesses. And the truth is, most Americans get their start the way I did, in a little firm. And so we must make it easier to start a business. We have to make it easier to prosper in a business. And if you ask small business owners why are they giving up, if you look down Main Street and see all those boarded up shops, people will tell you it's just too hard, the risks are too high, the rewards are too low, and I can't afford to hire teams of lawyers and accountants to help me figure out how not to get into trouble.
Carly, that crushing weight that you mentioned of regulation, how does that affect the U.S. in terms of international competitiveness? Can you say a few words about that?
Well, it hurts our international competitiveness. Look, it's obviously true that big businesses will benefit if, for example, we would reform our tax code so that our rates were no longer the highest in the world. But equally importantly, we have to radically simplify our tax code, because the truth is big companies benefit frequently from complex regulation, complex legislation, and complex tax codes. So when we make it harder for people to invent a new idea and make a business out of it, and that's what we're doing, it hurts our international competitiveness. And we are unique in the world. We are unique in the world in the power of our entrepreneurial spirit, and that is what has created the strength of our middle class. And so when we crush that, we are impacting in very deleterious ways not only our competitiveness abroad, but our quality of life here at home.
Let's go to a question in the back microphone, please.
I first heard you speak at a Hewlett-Packard stockholders meeting, and what I saw was confidence, integrity, and extreme communication abilities. What would you recommend to my 13-year-old niece? Would you recommend engineering, business, or law?
Oh, there's a loaded question. Honestly, what I would recommend to your 13-year-old niece is that she find what she loves, have the courage to take risks, to make mistakes, never let anyone tell her she cannot do something. But as my father once told me when I was 16 years old, follow your own star.
Here in the front, please.
Since I taught courses on Congress for many years, the first time I really knew about you was when you ran for the Senate. And it is tragic that you lost, because you are as terrific as the person you didn't defeat is lousy. My question to you is, you're from California, and California is a very tough state for people who believe in our way of life and our conservative principles. Would you consider moving next door to Nevada? I say that because Harry Reid desperately needs a good opponent in 2016.
Thank you for that compliment, but I must tell you that my husband and I moved back home to Virginia almost 4 years ago. So we live 25 miles down the road.
It seems that Senator Hatch, our next speaker, is running a few minutes late, so we'll probably have time for a few more questions if people want to line up for questions. Let's take this one.
Thank you for your talk. I actually do chemistry work, and so your comments about the unique role of the American entrepreneurial spirit, I think, are very important. Are you an optimist as you think about the challenges in the future, which you've talked a lot about those? Do you consider yourself an optimist as to the ability of that spirit to remain and to grow in our country, or do you see the perhaps a downward trend line on that?
I am a convicted optimist. And the reason I am a convicted optimist is because I have seen the power of human potential over and over and over. Someone once said to me, doesn't it take a lot of self-confidence to lead? And I said, yes, but more than that, it takes faith in the capability of others. Every wound we have in this nation is self-inflicted. Every problem we have can be solved. Our opportunity is to unlock and unleash the potential of this nation. And it can be done, but only if conservative principles are applied. And while I learn conservatism at my dinner table every night, I became a convicted conservative when I realized that it is only our principles that can lift people up.
John Hsu.
Carly, John Hsu from Newport Beach, California. What would your advice be today, in hindsight, for the California Republican Party, who's run a woman in 2010 for the governor's position and an Indian American man for the governor's position, both of whom, you know, scored less than 20 points behind against Governor Brown?
Well, I would say two things that I have learned about politics, either as a candidate myself or advocating for others or in the work that I did in this election cycle, activating women and bringing them to the polls in a number of states. First, I would say that the person with the most votes wins. I know it's an obvious statement, but when people underinvest in the ground game, or when someone else's ground game is really superior, when people just fail to show up to vote, you can't win elections. And so it is true in California that Democrats outnumber registered Republicans by almost 4-1, but it is also true that the ground game among the Republicans in California is lacking. And frankly, has been lacking across the nation in many ways. So votes matter. And when you have, for example, 17 million people who are conservatives who fail to show up at the polls in 2012, we lose elections. The second thing I would say about politics is all politics is personal. People make choices based upon what they think it means to them personally in their lives. And so while we can talk about high-minded ideals and important principles, unless we land those ideals and those principles in people's lives and explain to them how our principles will make their lives better, we will not win as many elections as we should.
This has been a terrific session. Thank you so much, Carly.
Thanks so much for having me.